Ladies and gentlemen, of course. Things are very poor in Kalgoorlie, so I've brought some material. I hope somebody will. This is all free, but it might lead you to buying some goodies. Yeah, I disagree with John Pascoe entirely. He said, don't forget to pay all this tax and do it and all this thing, but there's a way of avoiding payroll tax at least, and that's the sheet that tells you how to do it. Can be used for the group tax, the pay as you earn situation, but we barely need a test case. Material here, and what else we got? We got something, some little things. This is written by a fellow called Gary Sturgis. You'll be hearing a lot more of him. He's just joined the staff of the Bulletin. It's The Menace of the Quops, and it's a reprint from the Playboy magazine, and the Quops are the quasi cops, and I'll talk about them a little later. And this one's also called Time to Control Runaway Regulation. So good luck with those. Now, I felt that John gave us a little idea on what to do with these tickets as a way of saving money, you know, like a tax deduction. So I thought, well, I'll have to come up with something to match John at least on how you can save money. And I came across this entirely by accident today. And I parked my car at a parking meter and forgot to put any money in it. Came back hours later, and all the guys have got tickets front and back and everything, and there's my car and no ticket. I'd forgotten to put any number plates on my car. And I just picked up a new car, I was in a hurry, but there's a point. Now, it could be that we have sort of plug-in number plates, pull up the parking meter, off go the number plates in the boot. I can just imagine that bureaucratic guy coming along with his little book, writing all the details. Ah, no number, carefully form in his stump. Hasn't come across this before. So it's a thought, don't ever make their job hard, will you? You know, get along easy with them. I think it was easy for him, it saved him filling in a form. You know? And I think that John is quite right. And the other thing he says, keep a low profile and maintain the best relations at all times with these dreadful bureaucrats that we have to come up against. And we know that what they're doing is achieving the exact opposite of what they intend to do. The dreadful part about it is it's all at our expense. That's what we know. And one of my hobbies is keeping examples of how these well-intentioned bits of legislation have a result that's exactly the opposite. And if I can just touch one subject, it is a piece of legislation they brought out 3 or 4 years ago called the Hire Purchase Licensing Act. And before that time, almost every business selling equipment had a little in-house leasing company. And they'd sell some equipment to that company, and that little company would lease the equipment to any of you people who were leasing gear, whether it be cars or office equipment. And that little company of theirs had to pitch their leasing figures, their leasing rates, a couple of percent lower than the big boys. Okay? Otherwise, you'd deal with the big leasing companies. That was good. That was really good competitive stuff on the leasing, and leasing fee rates were reasonable. And, of course, the government came along under pressure from the big leasing companies and said, hey, I think we should have some perhaps a little bit of legislation, fellas. This to sort of restrict the competition a bit and to clean up the, you know, in the interests of consumer protection, of course, clean up this dreadful leasing market. All these sort of backyard leasing people are, you know, ruining the market, giving us a bad name. The government thought that was attractive because they could do this under the pretext of protecting the consumers. But think about it a bit. If the leasing company goes broke, there's all of us having leased something from them, we get that thing for free. Do we need any protection? That's beautiful. From that point of view, you know, there is no consumer to protect. There's nothing that he's got to protect from. He's got a free good if the company goes broke. But the government went along with it. They brought in this legislation, and my little company had a little side in-house leasing company called Hentry Os Proprietary Limited for some reason, and we were leasing these little office coffee machines to people at a great rate, like much lower than the main companies, and they were happy, everyone was happy. But the conditions came in, required an auditor, you know, a couple of grand a year for no purpose, required great assets, required submission of balance sheets, they must inspect you, they must walk in and do all these dreadful things. I looked at that and I said, oh, come on, you know, it's not worth it, they just pull out of it. And so many companies pulled out of leasing at that time, and coincidentally, leasing rates have never stopped going up. That's a classic example how the intention was to clean up the game, protect the consumer. The result was exactly the opposite.
Who's got the shares in those leasing companies? That's where it starts.
I don't think so. I think it's not so much the shareholders. And if you know and I know how much, say, a shareholder has got in a company these days, it's the dreadful coalition that's formed between big business and the government. You know, they do deals. Now, can I finish there, or can I go on and tell you why I'm wearing this spivvy shirt tonight?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, this spivvy shirt is because I am a leader in my field, and my field is that I'm an independent car dealer, among other things. Now, I call myself an independent car dealer. Ray O'Connor, the Minister for Consumer Protections, calls me a sneak car dealer, I think is his word, that they're trying to stamp out.
He'd be a sniper.
Yes. So what happened is they brought in something about 4 years ago called the Motor Vehicle Dealers Licensing Tribunal, which was like a blood brother to the High Purchase Licensing Tribunal, similarly. Now, you wonder why these things are brought in, but we're to blame, really, as much as anyone else, because we keep asking the government to do all these things. I've got an example here from this is last Sunday. The National Secretary of the Independent Truckers Association, you know, we know they're a great free enterprise organisation, they went on strike to sort of prove that they're rugged individualists and they don't need the government, they don't want to be licensed. He says he disagrees with the recent calls for licensing of the road transport industry and goes on to explain very lucidly why the licensing, you know, it's against the consumer's interest to license the trucking, because it'll increase costs. But then just 3 or 4 days later, in actually yesterday's Daily News, out comes the trucking industry demanding new legislation to control insurance broking firms. it's the same people. You know, we don't want it ourselves, but we do want it for somebody else. You know, free enterprise is great for us, but, you know, like, here we go. The truckies say they want to see government legislation to bring about uniform control over insurance brokers to protect the interests of people using them. Now, the problem down here is, of course, the CIB fraud squad is investigating the allegation, but it is understood that lack of legislation and legal technicalities are frustrating progress. Now, there apparently was fraud. If you've got somebody's money held in trust and you misapply it, that's fraud, and that's a matter for the police. It's not a matter for a kangaroo court, which is how these little tribunals and people operate. But we collectively, to a great degree, ask for these things, and we get them. You know, we'll get more and more of that. And that each of those organisations is what they call a Congo, or that's the sort of nickname that's been used for them. For about 6 months, I've been trying to find out how many of these Congos, these little entities of regulation that we have in West Australia.
What's a
Quango, Rob? Quasi-autonomous, non-government organisation, etc. Ditto. You know, zap.
Now, no accountability.
No accountability to anybody with an unlimited lifespan. I think they've still got this collector of scalps in Canberra. He's a Quango. We know how many there are in Canberra because Senator Ray took 3 years to find out how many there were. We don't know how many there are in West Australia, and we can't find them. We can't find any answer to it. We think it's between 230 and 290 of them. And the only way to sort of bring them to an end is with this sunset legislation, which is being introduced from the libertarian end of America and is now coming into Australia, which every new bit of legislation comes in must have a shelf life. You know? Must have a life so that it automatically terminates on a certain date. Preferably 5 years later. The state government's just brought one in with a 10-year terminating life. We think it's too long, but it's a great start. So where I thought I might just touch on a couple of points is is how I've maintained good relationships with this motor vehicle dealers licensing board, you know, because I think if I can tell you how to get along well with the people with which I have to work in government, then perhaps next time I come down, I can sit and you can, you know, each tell me how you best cement relationships with the people with whom you work. Now, this came along a while back and they sent me this bill saying, please send $100 or something to join this thing, you know, like the motor vehicle dealers licensing, whatever it was. So I wrote back and asked them what services they were going to provide, and they wrote back saying, well, they're going to protect me from competition for a year for this fee. now this is not exactly the words they used, but I mean, yeah, they put it delicately, but that's what they sort of said, you know, like, get together, fellas, because there's a lot of merit in this, and it was sponsored by the Automotive Chamber of Commerce, so it must be a good thing because they're terribly respectable. Now, they do have their own interests at heart, and, you know, one of them is to restrict competition. But anyway, I said, well, I'd rather not participate, thanks very much, you know, being a voluntary society, being free enterprise and all that. They can have their little party and, you know, group of monopolists, and I'll just carry on. Because I thought, well, all you've got to do in business is look after customers. You know, you look after them when they come back, and, you know, you keep going, and it's a pretty simple sort of a thing. And they're pretty hard to look after and keep happy. You know, and your principals that you're working for, they're pretty hard to keep happy, let alone getting in a sort of a separate group who I don't really see how I'm responsible to, because we're really paying them, you know. So if we're paying people, how can we be responsible to them? They're living off us, so, you know, I got all screwed up and said, no, I won't send the money. And a little while later, they sort of kept writing letters, you know, till I knew the Act pretty much off by heart. You know, they kept explaining it to me and how I'd missed a certain points, that there was a fine of $1,000 if I didn't send $100, and it was good value because if I send $100, it's really a saving of $900, you know, if I act quickly. I thought about it. It sounded pretty good because I'm a small businessman. I don't really have good accounting advice. I just sort of look at these things and sort of struggle through them. But I didn't do it, and then they sort of came along, and there's a sort of a court-martial thing, and they said, look, we've got this licensing board we've convened in Perth specially to meet you on this certain day at this certain hour, see? Because we want to, I think they didn't use the word interrogate, we wanted to question you, right? So I thought, well, it's okay, you know, it's no trouble, because I don't want to come into Perth, you know, you put some new clothes on and get jazzed up a bit. And I got down there, and I didn't mind coming because I felt that I really wanted to ask them some questions. You know, what was it all about? And anyway, there was, I think there was seven of them, they were sitting there, and they had me, yeah, same deal, John Littleton. There they were, and they sort of kept asking me, who was I, what was this, you know, all that sort of thing. And, you know, I was terribly snide and sneaky and all this thing, because I didn't want to sort of go along with this deal. But then I sort of said, well, who are you, you know, and I wanted to know exactly the background of every one of these seven guys. Yeah. Two of them were from the biggest car dealing firms in Perth, you know, and they said, well, what really do you seek from this organisation? And they said, well, we've got to have this industry cleaned up. And I said, what's the problem? And they said, it's all this unfair competition. And I said, well, just a minute, why is it unfair? You know, like, who is it? And they said, all these backyarders, they say, you know, people in their garage, they sell cars, any little service agent, sell cars. I said, what's unfair? And they said, it's unfair because they've got lower overheads than us and they can do business on a lower margin. And I said, that's probably dreadfully unfair to you, but it's probably very fair to them. And they're probably looking at you guys with your big shiny premises, air conditioned, saying, gee, we wish we were like them, you know, having it easy with secretaries and cups of coffee. You know, there's a horse for every course. And the people buying the cars from these guys are getting them at a cheaper price because there's sort of no warranty. The guy sort of says, well, there it is, take it or leave it, because it's half the price here, you know, than down the road. We had a freedom of choice as people to buy our particular good, being a car in this case, from anybody. But no, they had their angle. And the other guys, the public servants, there were a couple of them, and they sort of, you know, they just liked the job. You know, they said, well, I was a magistrate here, and it's like a sinecure, and I've been working all my life. Why shouldn't I get a good job? It's a non-terminating job, you know. So they were happy. And I went through these guys one after the other. And the chairman was a real good guy. Yeah, he was a good guy, and he'd been sort of kept saying, well, give us your balance sheet, you know. Give us it. Have you brought all those figures, all those statistics? And I said, well, just a minute, no, I haven't really, because I don't think I'll join, you know. And what happened next? Oh, that's right. I think he had a point. He said, we must protect the public because you guys just go out of business like that and the consumer is not protected. You just vanish. You know, you come, you're here today and you're gone tomorrow, and the public wanted better treatment than that. And I thought, well, gee, this is a pretty good time. So I invited the seven of them up to Calgary the next week when we were celebrating the 80th anniversary of our company. And I said, fellas, you're most welcome, but you've got to pay your own airfare. Suddenly they lost interest. But I got the message over, you know, like we've been around, and we're going to try to be around for a bit longer, you know. So anyway, that was it. I went back and nothing much happened, but they kept writing these letters. And in the end, they said I couldn't do something or other. So I said, in a fit of weakness, I wrote to them and I said something or other. Thanks for your explanation dated February the 9th. I thought, you know, mind if I just sort of briefly look at some of these letters? Okay, thanks for your explanation. Our payment, it's addressed to the chief bureaucrat. Motor Vehicle Dealers Licensing Board, that was in 1977. Thanks for your explanation. Our payment of $100 attached, being the protection money requested. We understand that this fires 12 months of government granted protection against competition from any other dealers who refuse to pay this protection money. Apparently, this legislation to which you refer, whilst masquerading as being of some benefit to consumers in it, is in fact another example of government restriction of trade and competition. It's one more example of government intervention in the marketplace, achieving the opposite to what may have been intended by well-meaning vote-seeking politicians under the influence of commercial pressure groups. While you may feel that we should be appreciative of your efforts to restrict competition, we know that we would adequately survive by serving our clients in a free marketplace, and look forward to the time when free enterprise system may be reintroduced. P.S. We are not enclosing the balance sheets or financial information as requested, as we feel that it is somewhat presumptuous for an employee to request such confidential information from their employer. I like to keep God in touch, so I sent a carbon copy of it to Charlie Court. I got another letter. I thought another letter to Charlie. I said, "Dear Sir Charles," actually. I thought that's fair enough, you know. I refer to our exchange of letters last year. This is good because Charlie was beefing off about the trouble he was having with the federal government bureaucrats. You know, dreadful, why do they invade? We are capable of running our own affairs. You know, get out. You know, so I wrote to him and I said, I appreciate the trouble you're having with these federal bureaucrats. The attached copy of the letter to the Motor Vehicle Dealers Licensing Board is a classic example of the bureaucrats frustrating the business community and is reminiscent of the disturbing parallel Solzhenitsyn draws between developments in Western countries and Russia. If I were a dog... No. If I were a dog, I suppose I would obediently wear my license without question. But as a human being, I take strong exception, perhaps belatedly, to the continuous frustration from people, many of whom would be regarded by private industry as unemployable. If the less productive members of a society truly seek security, let them rally to the defence of the freedom of choice and freedom of action of these who work for a living and who are personally productive. Let them voluntarily deal with one another in a marketplace kept free of compulsion. Such voluntary trading directs the instruments of production and the means of economic security into the hands of those most capable of serving all mankind. It promotes mutual respect for life and property. It stimulates every individual to develop his own talents to their maximum productivity. The free market, and not its displacement by government controls, is the only route to the kind of personal security which makes for a harmonious social relationship. If the bureaucrats have their own homemade laws on their side, where does one go nowadays for justice? Yeah. I saw Sir Charles about a week later, and he said something. He said, "Ron, do you mind if I don't reply to that letter?" There we go. And then, that's right. They didn't send me a receipt. $100. I wanted that because I thought a receipt would show that they'd accepted it on the basis it was protection money, you know. I wanted to keep it tidy. And I wrote back and I didn't get a reply, and then I said, they kept writing to me wanting money. So I wrote back saying something here, "We continue to receive high-handed circulars from you, drawing our attention to the fact that we have not completed the formalities of humbly begging you for permission to continue to in business. Our cheque, protection money to buy a licence, etc., was forwarded on September the 20th, 1976. We can understand the bureaucratic growth syndrome that confronts commerce today, and in all due respects, quote from a book review published in Today, the official journal of the Liberal Party of Australia, WA Division." It's a strange thing, I mean, I just happened to write it in the Liberal Party magazine. But it was a book review of Ayn Rand's book, Atlas Shrugged. It's a short quote, so I'll just take it, which I thought was pertinent, because it says, "When you see that trading is done not by consent but by compulsion, when you see that in order to produce you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing, you may know that your society is doomed." What happened next? A bit historic, isn't it? Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Next thing happened, about a year later they doubled the fees, you know? Like, they said, "Well, that was good, they're suckers, we got the money pretty easy, we'll sort of go for the high jump." So double the fees, think nothing of it, whoosh! And I thought, well, you know, it was a bit of a struggle meeting the $100 thing, because business has not been too good, you know? And I thought, well, that makes it impossible. You know, I get no value at $100, I get even half of that, $200. No way. So they took some legal action against me. Here we are. But I thought, well, who? I don't have a regular solicitor, because you pick the right horse, of course, you know. I said, now, isn't this poetic justice? I went to Julian Grill, who's the Labor Party member for Boulder Dundas, and I explained to Julian this dreadful trouble I was having with the Liberal Party bureaucrats. Would he be able to help me? Oh. Yeah. So we read a few things, and we got them all stitched up, and they got off my back. I think they're a bit out of sequence here, but anyway, I wrote to Sir Charles again. I said, "Dear Sir Charles, the attachments give details of how an individual employed a self-confessed socialist solicitor." And Julian's quite, I don't say that in an unfair statement, because he is proud of the fact he's a socialist, mainly because he doesn't know what it means. and mainly because he thinks it's linked with looking after the poor, you know. I say that not in a derogatory sense. I have the greatest admiration for Julian Grill. But I say to Sir Charles, the attachment give how I employed a self-confessed socialist solicitor to prevent me from a so-called free enterprise government. My great concern is that the state bureaucracy continues to grow at a faster rate than the taxpayers' ability to support it. I think this comes from just the time before that. Peter Samuel wrote this thing up in the Bulletin. I just quote. Can I quote from Peter Samuel in the Bulletin? Peter's now in charge of the Bulletin's New York department. You know? So it's a pretty big job over there. And Peter goes on. This is called. Called a matter of principle, he calls it. One correspondent, a car trader from WA, who's unnamed, writes, "Surely the freedom to trade is not a privilege, it's an inalienable right, with the only legitimate role for government being to provide law courts to dispense justice to deal with any criminal action. He has just defied the WA government demand for filling in all kinds of government forms in order to get a motor vehicle dealer's licence. He said it would suit him to comply because the scheme would restrict competition, but he believes in the tradition of the little guy having the right to compete with the big guys without having to gain favour of some bureaucrat. And he says that the licence payment is sheer protection money, because what they're really buying is protection against competition. He points out that any citizen has the right to trade, and we had this right long before government decided to respectabilise this traditional mafia revenue-raising technique. The end of the story is that after Cardlealer put his case with such vigour of principle, the bureaucrats decided to waive the requirement that he fill in all those forms and just accepted his money. Here we go. Now what happened next? Oh, it's too long. Too long, that one. So we had a bit of peace. We had about a year's peace. And then a few other car dealers heard that I was getting all the benefits.
Coming.
For free. See? The other car dealers. They said...
No, but if you feel so strong about this, so we'll think, why don't you just tell the government to go to Bagley and you won't do it?
That
is the obvious thing. That's the...
I thought it
that's
did.
The whole... No, you haven't.
Huh?
If you, no, if you tell the government, if you feel so strong...
Question time's coming.
If you feel so strong...
So what the other lawyers felt was that the... Here was a guy not paying this fee, and they were sort of a bit envious that they weren't... getting the same deal. So they went to the government and said, increase the penalty from $1,000 to $3,000, because that'll bring him into line, see? And Graydon's came up here with this thing, crackdown on sneak car dealers. And they've increased the fee, and that's a pretty steep sort of a penalty. And I think John, what's his name, Clydesdale of the Sunday Times says that the crackdown on backyard dealers comes after almost 4 years of pressure by licensed dealers in the WA Automobile Chamber of Commerce. They have claimed that enormous amounts of business is going to backyard dealers. That's entirely freedom of choice on who buys from who. That's all I mentioned that for. So this $3,000 fine is a bit of a problem, So I looked at that and I said, well, there's some action brewing. So nothing much happened till I tried to put an advertisement in the local newspaper for cars, and the guy said, oh, Ron, listen, we can't accept your advertisement because you haven't got your licensed dealer number to put on the advertisement. And we've got an advice from the Motor Vehicle Dealers Licensing Board that we, too, will be fined $3,000 if we accept your advertisement. So, I thought, well, that's no good problem because I went and used the radio instead of the newspaper, So off I went to the radio, and the newspaper guys got upset. The radio was getting all my advertising, and the newspaper was missing out. So I thought, well, you ought to go to the Trade Practices Act and sort of take your action against the government for discriminating between one section of the media and the other. But I don't think they did anything. But there were three things that all happened in rapid sequence, which I thought was, the game was holding up a bit. So here we go. That was the first one. The second one was that the Road Traffic Authority said they noticed I haven't got a dealer's number, so they felt that I should pay stamp duty twice, when we bought the cars from the clients and when we sold them again, because if you're a dealer you only sort of pay the stamp duty once, not in and out, so they made it very hard there, so they've got a bit of correspondence there. But what we do is we just don't license them at all. Saves a bit more money. But we insure them. We do insure them. We're quite serious about it. We got a letter from one of our principals that said, Dear Ron, this letter is to warn you privately that the Department of Consumer Affairs is currently conducting an investigation like this into your licence, etc. In a recent interview with one of the department's investigating office, it was revealed that you may not have a licence. A failure to keep your licence current will result in a fine of up to $3,000 plus a penalty of $100 per day that such licence remains invalid. We were informed that we, and they named their name of the company, will also be held liable for these same fines if we continue to trade with unlicensed dealers. See? So, well, that's a problem, that I just sort of lost supply of my cars, so... I can't license them, I can't get any cars myself. But I still get customers who want to deal with me, and I said, well, that's encouraging, so I thought I'd do something about it today. So I'm down here today, and what inspired me was this Milton Friedman quoted this. He said, the underlying most arguments against the free market is a lack of belief in freedom itself. Well, I guess that's what the government just doesn't believe in freedom at all. Otherwise, why would it keep blocking it like this? So, anyway, there's three alternatives open to me. and it's like an exercise, you know, all this sort of thing. One alternative is to have the motor vehicle dealer's license board abolished, you know. Let's get rid of it. And it's not so funny because there's a guy in England called Anthony Fisher who used to have the biggest chicken outfit there, and he had a lot of trouble with the egg board. And they were giving him a real hard time, and he worked it out that the egg board was increasing the price of eggs about 30% on what the producers could sell without the egg board getting involved. And he mounted an attack. He started to think of the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, and, you know, before very long, he'd exposed these people for what they were really doing, and the egg board vanished, and they haven't had an egg board in England ever since. So it's not so hard, you know. So that's one alternative. The other alternative is to sort of somehow find a way around it, and we've done this today because I'm now a South Australian car dealer operating West Australia. And what I have on my side is Section 92 of the Constitution. Now, do you know what Section 92 says? It guarantees free trade, and I read this, I said it guarantees free trade and intercourse across boundaries. I read that, and you know what I said? I said you can keep your free trade, I'll just have the intercourse. But that's what it does. So I'm a South Australian car dealer operating here. I can draw the cars from there. They can't stop them coming across the border because if they want to, they've got a constitutional battle on their hands. So that's fixed that. And there's another thing called the Trade Practices Act that is a federal thing, and it sort of reigns, if there's anything higher than Charlie's group, it's the federal situation. And if I can put a dollar value on the fact that they've deprived me of any livelihood, I can take action against these people under this Trade Practices Act. And that could be interesting. But I think the best move of them all is to do the lot. Abolish them and still push this constitutional thing and have a go. Can I? Now, a lot of you may think that I take this very lightly. I don't, really. I think it's a most serious thing. Anyway, what got me down here to sort of talk to these people today about this was that I... just a few weeks ago, it was the beginning of WA Week. You know, it was a very good week. West, we celebrate our heritage and everything, I think, WA Week. Sitting quietly in my office, not doing anything. I think I was minding my own business. I think we were sort of masterminding this New Hebrides sort of thing, or helping with the Constitution do something, you know, pretty inane at the time. And into the office, you know, storm these two blokes, blue uniforms, nearly looking like cops. Nearly, not quite, you know. Caps to work. Boom, boom, you know, stormed up the counter, clicked their heels. We would like to speak to Mr. Manners, please. Right? And I looked up, I saw him there, and I thought, gee, if I was Jewish, I bet that I could smell the gas chambers at this particular moment. But, I wasn't Jewish, and I didn't smell anything. But they had the style about them. So I brought them in, and I asked them what it was all about, and they introduced themselves. They were the special investigators that had been put on by the RTA to stamp out this dreadful thing, you know. So they wanted to ask me all these questions because, as they said, they understood that I was operating without a licence. And I said, well, it's no secret. I've never kept it a secret. I mean, I'm quite proud of this. I'm an independent car dealer, and that's a great way to be, you know. And so on we went with the whole thing again, and I asked them all these questions, and they were sort of... It was a real big... To them, it was a really big deal. There was a matter of principle involved in it, and I think... I was worried, you know, that they were sort of thinking that I was a naughty sort of fellow. You know, I was trying to get along well, because you can see that's the idea. And then I sort of asked them, firstly, had there been any complaints? You know, had any clients complained about me? And they said, oh, no. I said, well, have any of our principals complained about me? Oh, no. And I said, have any other car dealers complained about us? No. I said, well, what is the problem? So we sort of talked a bit. And they kept on saying, what was I going to do about it? And I said, what would you like me to do about it? And they said, we would like you to pick up the phone, ring the Motor Vehicle Dealers Licensing Board at Perth, and promise that you'll have your check in today's mail. Well, I sort of explained that I was a bit busy, you know, and I sort of allocated about as much time as I could to unproductive pastimes that particular day. And the way they went, so they gave me about a week. They gave me about a week, and I think a week's just about a month's cutting out, so I thought I'd better check it out. But... what really, and I guess this is the message, and this is what I was thinking, really, all the time that they were talking to me. I just couldn't help thinking, if we can only just lift those guys up from the unproductive sort of regulatory sector and lift them over onto the other side of the fence to join the productive members of the population. If we could do that, what a wonderful country and what a wonderful state we could all be living in.
You made of me was in the Industrial Magistrates Court on the 5th of July, and then again on your veranda on the 5th of November. So that would have been the third time in seeing you. No further questions, Your Worship?
Your Worship, could I just comment? I just feel that the summons states that we've failed to produce time and wages records, but at no stage did Mr. Fitzgerald either identify himself or ask to see the books. And as a matter of fact, I've pointed out that it was only sometime later that I realised who he was. The summons and the evidence produced does not disclose any offence on the part of W.G. Manners and Co. So I submit, Your Worship, that we have no case to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Yes, Mr. Fitzgerald, on the evidence before me, there's not sufficient evidence to satisfy me beyond reasonable doubt that Mr. Manners here knew to find that you were Mr. Fitzgerald from the union coming to inspect his record. It seems that you'd gone there with presupposed ideas, and when he said, no, I'm too busy for an interview this week, you tossed up your hands or give it to him, and throw his hand type of thing and just left for him. I think you ought to say, listen, I'm Fitzgerald from the union and I want to inspect your record. The point to respect the record, and it does seem that there was this failure. It's not, certainly not clear at all that he knew that you were there then to make an appointment to inspect the record. So I really have to find the charge, and it's not proved in this case.
Your Worship, I'm inclined to agree with you on that score.
I'm glad of that.
Not all of them do, apparently.
No.
Thank you, Your Worship.
Thank you very much.
Industrial Court.